Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following recording takes place at the 2011 Roots of Change Conference in Portland, Oregon, which was sponsored by the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and Men Can Stop Rape. Speakers and workshops address the primary prevention of sexual violence with a strong focus on media, entertainment, and pop culture. Themes regarding men and masculinity were woven throughout the conference proceedings. Jacqueline Friedman, Executive Director of Women, Action, and the Media, the editor of Yes Means Yes, and the author of What You Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety, discusses how building a stronger relationship with our authentic sexuality is a powerful act of resistance.
What I want to talk about today is the truism that gets said over and over in sexual assault prevention work, which is that rape has nothing to do with sex. We say this, we hear it, we repeat it, and we know what's true about that, right? Of course, it's not a sexual act, it's not an act of sexual incontinence, and that's what's meant by that. But I think that in a lot of our work, sometimes we let the meaning bleed, and we pretend that rape has nothing to do with sexuality and with the way the culture deals with sexuality, and I want to sew that hole shut here today a little bit. And I just want to start by establishing a metaphor for the dominant paradigm of sexuality that we're sort of all soaking in today. How many of you remember those Palmolive ads? You're soaking in it. This represents sort of the dominant way that sexuality gets conceived. And specifically, I'm interested here in the diamond, right? The diamond very clearly symbolizes lady vagina, right? Like the lady sex. The abstinence folks are not that concerned with whether or not the men are saving their diamond for a brighter future, right? It's very clearly that diamond is a vagina. And in this model, which I call the commodity model of sex, and I didn't coin that term either, the vagina is the most valuable possession a woman has. Her role in responsibility to that vagina is to keep it safe, to save it, to leave it unopened and untouched until she can make the best trade possible for it, which is, of course, for a diamond and a husband. On the flip side, the guy in this interaction is always a guy, and we'll talk about that in a second. His responsibility toward that diamond, that untouched lady sex, is to get it and pay as low a cost as possible, ideally not give out one's phone number, right? And that's our basic dominant market-based paradigm of the way that we culturally conceive of sex right now, the commodity model of sex. A lot of messed up things about this, and we don't have time to talk about all of them necessarily right now, but I do want to point out some of them. First of all, it's wicked heteronormative. There are no queer people, there are no trans people, there are no gender nonconforming people, there are no people other than super straight ladies and dudes who want to insert tab A and slot B. That's where we start with. So it excludes tons of people just right from the jump. Also, it leads to ideas like, if I'm a lady and this is my delicious untouched lady sex, somebody asks me for it 20 times, and each of those 20 times I say no, 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 and the 21st time I say, you know what, fine. That's legit in the commodity model of sex. That's contract. I agreed, mixed my feelings, my experiences. It's a market transaction. Let's say that's my lady sex some more, and I'm like, oh, look, a shiny thing is over here. And I look back, and someone has taken it. I'm going to get blamed for that, because I obviously didn't value it that much. If I had been paying better attention, it wouldn't have happened if I really valued it. So a lot of the messed up cultural tropes about sex and sexual violence stem from this commodity model of sex. And I want to take a look at some of them. So, for example, our fetish for virginity. This is from a few years ago now. This girl had an online auction for her virginity, and someone paid $2 million for it. $2 million to have sex with someone who had no sexual experience. Theoretically, I mean, virginity is also a contested concept also, but only works if we treat sexual experience is like some commodity, is like the extra virgin pressing. Otherwise, why would it be valuable to interact with someone who has no experience doing the thing that you're doing together? It doesn't make any sense unless you are thinking of sex as a commodity. I love how this article is about how Katy Perry made him wait. It's about like how she restrained her sexuality and she was all a proper girl, and yet she's completely sexual available to the reader, right? And that's what we expect of girls in the culture, right? Is to be sexy and sexually available at all times, and to be the policer and the gatekeepers of no at all times simultaneously. honestly. That's totally commodity model. This is an ad from a men's magazine called Che, which the existence of a men's magazine called Che is like a whole different talk. But the slogan is keep on dreaming of a better world, and the better world is one in which you can literally control a whole lady. And, of course, not just any lady, thin, white, young, conventionally pretty, able-bodied, et cetera, et cetera. These are ads for Tucker Max's movie. How many of you know who Tucker Max is? Tucker Max is a guy who's made his career telling stories about being a drunken, sexually violent asshole, and he might even agree with that description. And he wound up with a book about that that was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 100 weeks. And then he made a movie out of that book with his own money, and the movie failed, which makes me very happy. But we learned something from the ads for this movie, which is that not all ladies in the commodity model are valued equally. If you're a stripper, if you're engaging in sex work in any way, if you're not valuing your own sexuality, then we can totally disrespect you. We don't owe you anything if you're not respecting yourself by saving it, right? All that's all commodity. Also, blind girls, girls with disabilities, for example, girls who are less valued by the culture, whose bodies are coded as less valuable, you can totally rape them, and that's funny, right? So you have to actually be a particular kind of lady to get the right exchange value for your lady sex. Some of you may be familiar with this ad.
It's the cradle of life. It's the center of civilization. Over the ages and throughout the world, men have fought for it, battled for it. Died for it. One might say it's the most powerful thing on earth.
So come on, ladies, show it a little love. Cleansing wash and cloths from Summer's Eve. Hail to the V.
So your vagina is the most powerful thing. The word thing actually is really where I get hung up there on earth. And we don't have time to unpack that whole thing, but you're smart people, right? Like, unpack on your own. Now, the flip side of this are the abstinence advocates. They will tell you that they are trying to be a countervening force against the Tucker Maxes of the world, but they're selling the same commodity model of sex. If you accept that the commodity model is the only model that exists, they are giving good advice, right? So if this is the only model we can have, they're trying to encourage girls to sort of make the best deal they can for themselves. But they're still treating, I mean, there's no subtext here to unpack. Is there? You can buy this t-shirt at the Abstinence Clearinghouse. This is a virginity voucher you can also purchase. It is a credit card. It's a piece of plastic, a credit card-shaped piece of plastic you keep in your wallet that is, it reads, redeemable on wedding day. Literally cashing in your V card, right? Like, and all of this leads to stuff like that we saw this year, where Bristol Palin, in her memoir, who is a noted abstinence advocate and also teen mother, who said, described being raped by Levi Johnston, right? I don't know how many of you followed this, but she said, she had said she didn't want to have sex. They were camping, got drunk on wine coolers. She woke up the next day, didn't know what happened, and found out that they'd had sex while she was passed out. Like, that's rape, probably by anybody in this room's definition. But she went to great pains to say, no, I wasn't raped, but my virginity was stolen. Right? So this commodity model language gets used also to downplay sexual violence in this very explicit way in the hands of the abstinence people as well. So all of this points to an important distinction that we often fail to make in our work and that fails to get made everywhere. It's not just us, which is the difference between sexuality and sexualization. And that's what I want to spend a lot of time talking about today. And in order to do that, we're going to have to watch another unpleasant video, but we're only going to watch a little bit of it. I'm a single lady. That's enough of that, isn't it? Yeah, sorry. So let's agree to a few things. How many of you think that it looks like these girls, who are, by the way, 7 and 8 years old, how many of you feel like they look like they're having a good time? Raise your hands. I do. How many of you think they are freaking badass dancers? Okay, so we've got 7 year girls doing something they're awesome at and having a great time. So what? Why are we really creeped out by this video? What? What about them being babies? They're hypersexualized. How do we know that? The song? The song, I mean, don't get me started on if you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it. Like, that's also a totally commodity model of sex. What else? The song? What else? What they're wearing? They're wearing basically lingerie outfits. Now, 7-year-old girls may have some sexual or sensual sense in their bodies, but they don't express it by wearing these clothes. This is a very narrowly coded adult idea of sexuality. And there's one more thing. The choreography, right? They're doing essentially stripper moves, again, which is not how 7-8-year-old girls will express whatever sexual or sensual impulses they have in their bodies. So it's pretty clear to us that they are being sexualized. Now, the American Psychological Association did a really great study on sexualization, which I recommend all of you check out. And here's how they defined it. Sexualization occurs when one or more of these conditions are met. A person's value comes only from his or her sexual appeal or behavior to the exclusion of other characteristics. So think about all of the abstinence-only virginity stuff is just as sexualizing as the Tecromax stuff, in part because it's still saying the most important thing about you girls is what you do or don't do with your sexuality. It doesn't matter if you're a good friend or if you're smart or good at sports or anything. Like, whatever you're doing with your vagina, because, of course, that's how sex gets narrowly defined here, that's the only thing that matters. A person's held to a standard that equates physical attractiveness narrowly defined with being sexy, which, of course, leaves most of us out of being sexy at all ever in our lives, which we know is patently ridiculous. A person is sexually objectified, and this is key, I think, that a person is being made a thing for somebody else's use. Sometimes it's sexual use. Sometimes someone's being sexualized to sell something, right? And not being an agent on behalf of their own sexuality. And that's really the delineation that I look for a lot of time. Or, as we saw in that video, sexuality is inappropriately imposed on a person. So basically, the basic virgin whore conundrum that is promoted to girls across the culture. I should say only some girls get the virgin whore option. Some of them don't get the virgin option, right? So women of color a lot of the time don't even get the chance to be coded virginal by the culture. And I'm not talking about whether they are virgins or not, but whether or not the culture will read them that way or give them the opportunity to take that position in the culture. Sexualization has real consequences. The APA found that it causes impairment on mental activities, including math and logic. And if you think about the science and math performance gap between men and women and how it's supposed to be biological, and then think about the number of sexualized images we're all exposed to every day. Eating disorders, low self-esteem, depression, unrealistic or negative expectations concerning sexuality. And it also causes in men who like sleeping with women a difficulty finding partners that seem acceptable because most of us women who are actual flesh and blood and complicated, weird people don't live up to that sexualized, airbrushed ideal. So sexualization has a lot of real consequences, and it also has a real consequence that the ADA didn't study, although I wish they had, which it creates social license to operate for rapists, okay? I'm using social license to operate sort of interchangeably with rape culture. The sociological concept of social license to operate means we are all granting somebody a license to do something that otherwise they couldn't do, right? And that's what rape culture does. I find when I give talks to people who are not like this room that if you say rape culture, their eyes just sort of like, you lose them. So I go with social license to operate anyway. So I don't know, last year if you saw this was all the rage that junior high schools and high schools were circulating slut lists. It's only smut lists because Facebook wouldn't allow the word slut, but these are actual slut lists. And listing like the ranking, the top sluts in the school. first of all of them are girls, right? So that's already a really messed up gendered coding. And it the lists have very little to do with what girls are doing what sexually, right? It's about which girls are out of line, which girls dress in a certain way, which girls are loud or have bodies that don't meet the virginal ideal, or, you know, so the concept of sluthood and sexualization often has very little to do with what a girl may or may not be doing sexually. And that's important to note. And that takes us here. How many of you heard about the Amber Cole case that happened recently? All right, I apologize for having to even tell you about this. So a few weeks ago, a 14-year-old girl gave a 14-year-old boy a blowjob. I have to tell you, I'm not at all scandalized by that information. But I am by the context around it. He was her ex-boyfriend. She was trying to get him back. He said, if you love me, you'll do this. And there happened to be two other boys present, one of them with a video camera. And that boy posted the video to Facebook, and it went internationally viral. Now, that's illegal, A, and I mean, I can't even talk about how disgusting it is. I don't literally don't have words for it. But also what happened after that in the media is what I actually want to point out, which is we know Amber's name. She, with all everything that happened, was like, oh my God, why would a 14-year-old girl do something like that? How could she let herself be in that position, right? It was all about shaming and blaming her. We still don't know the names of the boys who committed this felony of producing and distributing child pornography, right? No shame has been on them. And actually, I gave this talk, I talked about this issue at the University of Oregon in Eugene a couple of nights ago, and there happened to be a young woman in the audience who's from the town in which this happened and said, like, that the boys are being treated as heroes, right? The boys are being treated as heroes. This is where sexualization leads us, social license to operate. It also leads to the ruling recently by this charming fellow, who is a judge in Winnipeg, Canada, who ruled on a rape case where the rapist had been convicted. He had followed a couple of women from a party, and they were dressed like women do to go to parties. And he raped one of the women in the woods. She said, are you going to kill me? He said, don't worry, this won't take very long. It was not an ambiguous case. He was convicted, but this charming guy refused to give him a sentence because he said sex was in the air and there was a heightened expectation that sex would occur, right? That's what sexualization does in terms of creating social license to operate for rapists. So he got no sentence whatsoever, even though he was convicted in open court. They are appealing this. That's in process. Judge Dewar said, this is a different case than one where there is no perceived invitation. This is a case of misunderstood signals and inconsiderate behavior. This is where sexualization leads us. It also leads us here to when the Assange case came out. How many of you followed this? Naomi Wolf and many other people, although shockingly enough from someone who claims to be a feminist, was like, oh, those women, one of whom described being held down and have her legs forced open, the other one who was penetrated while she was asleep, those women are just jealous, right? They're just bitter because he was not super a nice date. And because the assumption was they went home with him. One of the writers on this issue actually said, you buy your ticket, you take the ride. That's where sexualization gets us. The only thing that matters is if you are a woman who's willing to be sexual, it is open season on your body. Also, we will accuse you of being a hooker if we need to, especially if you're a poor woman of color and it seems like it might stick, an immigrant. Right? These are all the cases that make the headlines. Now, we could go on and on, but Carol Kowicki actually, this is adapted from her blog at The Curvature. This is Rape Apology Bingo. We're not going to go through this. I'm sure you're well familiar with all of these victim-blaming excuses, but I do want to note how many of them have to do with a female victim's sexuality, right? So much of this is tied into sexualization and the demonizing of women who are sexual. But as you know, the stronger these myths are in our culture, the worse the consequences are. And there's actually a study done in the aftermath of the Kobe Bryant case that showed that there are that that the what when people are exposed to rape myths in the media, they're more likely to believe them, and other things flow from that too. The victim would be less likely to self-identify as a victim and also obviously to report. Perpetrators are less likely to self-identify their own inclinations or behaviors as violent. And I think almost most chillingly, the people in the justice system that we count on, if somebody actually does manage in this culture to actually bring charges, are a lot less likely to take this seriously if they've been exposed via the media to these damaging rape myths. So the result of all of that, as you well know, is literally more rape, because most perpetrators are going to do it again. We give them a blank check. We let them go. We are literally bringing more rape into the world. So the more the media plays into these sexualized myths about women and sexual violence, and even just the myths about women's sexuality that uphold these, the underpinnings of this victim blaming, the more we are actually producing rape in the world. And all of this is ultimately gets boiled down to sort of perpetuating the myth of the perfect victim. I'm sure you're familiar with this idea. Anyone know who this is? Anyone want to guess? What? Oh, you're sweet. No. I was so awkward at that age. That was Polanski's victim at the age she was raped. Now, we want to talk about the perfect victim. Let's talk about it, right? She's white. She's young. She's sweet, right? She's, you know, she's upper, you know, she's not, you know, poor. You know, she's... What a good girl. Would we not think of this as a picture of virginity in some ways? But two things she fell down on, right? She wasn't a virgin at the time, and she wasn't wildly wealthy, right? And so because he was wildly wealthy, everyone said, oh, they cooked it up for money. This is a girl who was given quaaludes against her will, and then over her verbal protestations, anally raped by a much, she was 13, older man. Older, powerful man, and we still did not believe her, and then we didn't believe her again when it came back around a few years ago, right? And so what I like to say, and it was just true, is like, given that she didn't get believed, the rest of us are hosed, right? Like, if we're in a culture that she doesn't get believed, this face doesn't get believed, the rest of us are hosed. Now, today's version of the perfect victim, or our... sort of on the flip side of that, our sort of purity princess, right, is Taylor Swift. She is, I assert, our reigning purity princess. Do I know if she's a virgin personally? No, but that's not material here, right? It's about what she symbolizes. On the flip side, we have Rihanna, right? Now, Rihanna is a complicated case, and we're going to talk about it in a minute, but what I want to talk about is the way that they're each portrayed. Look at those images side by side, because this is your virgin whore. And basically in the culture right now, in our sexualized culture, women are given the option of being one or the other, if we're lucky, right? Pick one and do as well as you can at it. It doesn't matter what you actually want. It doesn't matter if your desires change over time. It doesn't matter anything human about you. Pick one and stay in your freaking lane, right? That is the only thing valuable about you. And we start early on this message. Right? Very early. But let's talk about Rihanna for a second, because obviously that's a complicated case. Domestic violence being different in some ways, obviously, than sexual violence, but in terms of victim blame, the culture dynamics are pretty similar. So this is what Rihanna looked like around the time that she was assaulted. And when all those pictures of her bloodied, bruised face went around TMZ, the Boston Globe did a survey of high school students, who's 51% of whom said she must have done something to bring it on herself, right? She doesn't fit our perfect victim because A, she's not white, and B, she doesn't portray virginity. But that's it. I mean, she's rich, she's young, she's pretty, you know, she's got a lot of cultural power, but still, we are blaming the crap out of her because we have been, again, it's that boiling frog thing that Christine so helpfully brought up. We've been prepared to blame her since long before Chris Brown hit her, right? We're raised to do that by this sexualization in the culture and by the media repeating these ideas over and over again. Because look at Chris Brown. He has a puppy. He is in a milk ad. Chris Brown would never do something bad. I heard someone last night refer to how we have this intractable idea in the culture of rapists as, like, visibly monstrous, right? And that is what's happening here, right? Chris Brown looks like the boy next door, depending on your neighborhood. and we don't want to believe that the boy next door would do something because that makes us feel unsafe. It doesn't make us actually unsafe. It makes us safer to realize the boy next door might do this, but it makes us feel unsafe. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, too. I want to do a little thought experiment here just to illustrate my point. What if, instead of Rihanna being beat up by her black boyfriend, it had been Taylor Swift? What do you think would have been the cultural response? There would have been vigils in the street with candles. Think about what happened when she was interrupted by a black man. I mean, seriously, right? And that is all you need to know about how this plays out in the culture, except this other little nugget, which is that when I first started using this example here, talking about the Rihanna case, I used this slide instead of Taylor Swift. But I can't do, somebody already understands why I can't do that anymore, which is because Miley has started posing for pictures looking like this. And I want to talk about this picture for a second, because I think probably most of us are looking at this picture and thinking, that's sexualization right there. And we're right in the sense that it portrays a really narrow idea of what's sexy and what's sexually appealing, and she's posed in a really passive, sexually available way, and there are a lot of sexualized things about this image. But I also want to say this. Miley Cyrus was 17 when she posed for this picture. And I think about my 17-year-old self and how excited I was about sexuality and how freaking exciting it was. And if I had access to that photographer and that set and that wardrobe, would I have posed for that picture? Damn fucking right I would have. I would have loved it, right? And that would have been authentic to me, right? I would have been exploring this shiny, crazy new thing that was my sexuality. And so I want us to sort of also think about removing judgment when we talk about sexualization about the participants, because just because an image perpetuates sexualization in the culture doesn't mean the participants are also just victims, right? Two things I think are happening in this picture, which is Miley is becoming a sexual person, and we treat her, when she does that, like she's killing puppies on live television, right? And the other is that this is a sexualized image. Both are true. Now, what would happen if Miley got beat up or raped? She'd be punchline on late night TV. And we would, as a culture, wring our hands and be like, oh, well, we saw that coming, right? Like, that's what you get for going down that road of being sexual in some vague way and smoking pot. Right? Like, I'm not going to ask you to self-disclose, but I have done both of those things. That doesn't make me a crazy monster. It does not make me deserve sexual violence. But that's what we do. If you cross that line, all bets are off if you are a female in this culture. I should, as a caveat, this talk very much focuses on female sexuality in the culture. I think men also get a raw deal. I literally... this is my focus of my work, so I just want to acknowledge that this is not the whole picture. Okay, so we know that sexualization has real consequences, so what do we do about it? Well, a lot of times what we do is we protest when we see it, right? So this T-shirt came out, I think it was at JCPenney, I'm too pretty to do homework so my brother does it for me. That's completely sexualizing. And there was a campaign on social media and elsewhere to get it pulled, and then it got yanked, and that's great. I'm super psyched about that. But we need to be careful in this sort of reactive model not to fall into bed with people that we don't actually want to make allies with. For example, this conservative group got the sweaty balls flavor of Ben and Jerry's pulled from shelves because what would children think about ice cream named sweaty balls? They would think, what? Is it good? Right? Like, because when we go too far on this, we police any sexuality being portrayed in any way, in any context in the culture, and context really matters. The Parents Television Council is one of the main offenders here. They got into it with Rihanna's Man Down video. I'm bringing this up just because we talked about Rihanna. So I don't know how many of you saw that video of a song she had out this summer, which was a revenge fantasy. It depicted her being sexually violated. I mean, not graphically, that's what was suggested, and then she shoots the perpetrator. And the Parents Helping Council was like, you're being a bad victim by, you know, acting out your revenge fantasy. You're encouraging violence. And you think about the amount of violence that men perpetrate in music videos ad infinitum. And also the fact that Rihanna did not sign up to be the spokesmodel for domestic violence. She's a pop star, and she's expressing a thing that's true for her. But we police this really hard at our detriment because we make enemies. We draw lines in the sand, and the people we want to reach, especially young people, are on the other side. Parents Television Council also went after Glee. Now, Glee is a bad offender on sexualization on a lot of fronts, but they went after them early, actually on one of my favorite scenes that I've ever seen on television, right? So this is episode 2 of Glee, back when it still looked like it might be smart and good, in which Rachel, the Selby Club, makes a speech about how girls actually like sex too. And then later on, they like deal with like teen boys having issues with premature ejaculation. They like have this funny scene where the kids try to sex it up, and it actually backfires on them. But the Parents Television Council misses all that context, and if they see anything sexual on the television, whatever it's portraying, it's bad, and they protest. And that is where we need to be careful not to go. It's a slippery slope when our only response is a reactive one. When we are reactive about sexuality in our media, we can wind up being the people who take the toys away. Because let's face it, sexuality is fun. We forget this a lot of the time, especially when we're doing sexual violence work, but sexuality is important. It's core to most of our identities. And young people feel that way too, sometimes more than we do, right? Because it's like this giant new thing. And it can feel like your favorite toy. Now, this was my favorite toy when I was a kid. I'm going to show you slides of it just because I loved it so much. It was my ShopRite truck. I kept all of my other trucks in it. It was so awesome. Did anyone else have one of these? Yes! Love. Okay. And when we say, like, no sexy television, no sex in the media, that's bad. It's influencing our youth, right? That's what it's like. We are taking toys away, right? We do not want to be that people, both because why take the toy of sexuality away? Sexuality is awesome. And also because it's completely counterproductive in terms of trying to change cultural messaging around sexuality and around sex. Also, when we only have a reactive option, even if we really do it carefully and only in the sexualizing context and really can take context into thoughtfully, and we don't go the Parents Television Council route, we still leave the culture with only two dominant options for female sexuality, right? At best, again. We're not contributing anything to shifting that conversation. We're only policing it around the edges. So let's talk about what it could look like otherwise, right? What would it look like if there was positive sexuality, complicated sexuality in our media? The good news is there is a little that we can look at. So I'm going to show some examples. Beth Ditto. How many of you are gossip fans? Beth Ditto is badass. She is really, she's a out and proud fat activist, really proud of her body, proud of her sexuality, will pose for stuff like this. I love her really aggressive gaze at the camera here. It's not like, come get me. It's like, yeah, you want this, right? Like, but also she like just takes her freaking pants off at her shows and shows her Spanx, right? Like, she's very in your face with her sexuality. It's complicated, but she is, if nothing else, completely the subject of her sexuality. And that's what we're looking for here, right? Also, Missy Elliott. Missy Elliott has really sexy lyrics sometimes, really sexy videos, but she never, you never see her parading around in like a little tiny video ho outfit, right? Even on her Get Your Freak On video, she is fully clothed. It's shocking. Also, always the subject, not the object of her sexual messages. How many of you are Amanda Palmer fans? Amanda Palmer of the Dresden Dolls is a sort of indie darling. She's done some problematic stuff. I just want to acknowledge that. But she has a video called Map of Tasmania, which is all about how awesome full bushy pubic hair is and how you don't need to have to shave it. And it's all images of like the craziest merkins that you could imagine. That's Starry, Starry Night. This is one of my favorite ones. So there are lots of ways to go about, isn't this awesome? Yeah, this, I love it. Love, 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 right? So there are, and these are just the examples that I'm aware of, but you in your own communities and the own sets of media that you consume probably have different examples, but we need to be thinking of and talking about and sharing with each other what positive images of sexuality looks like, because getting rid of the negative images is not enough. It still leaves us just with those two poles. On TV, there are some few examples. So Katie Segal on Sons of Anarchy is postmenopausal and sexual. She has dealt with vaginal dryness. She's like, you know, she's a woman in charge of her family. You know, she is a complicated sexual character that you don't see a lot on television. Similarly, a lot of the characters on The Good Wife are interestingly sexual. I happen to think Bridesmaids, again, I had a few problems with Bridesmaids, but mostly loved it. But there was this great scene, this is not a screen cap from it, because I couldn't find a screen cap from that scene. There's a great scene early in the movie where these two characters are talking about Kristen Wiig, who's the blonde's friends with benefits arrangement with this odious character that John Hamm plays, really hysterically. And Maya Rudolph's character is like, you need to get out of that, you need to end it. But none of it is because, like, you're hooking up without a commitment. It's all like, he makes you feel bad. You feel bad after you are with him. That is why you need to stop it, not because you're ruining your chances at finding a husband by playing around casually or any of that. It's treated very normatively that she's making a choice about her, what, how to express her sexuality, and the only problem with it is this choice is making her feel bad. That's a positive message about how to make decisions about sexuality. You can also find positive sexual options in video games. As much as I'm not a first-person shooter type, I did some ask from friends for suggestions also, and a friend of mine said that in this game, Fallout New Vegas, you can play whatever color or gender you want. There are straight, gay, lesbian, bi speech options when you talk about sex. Everyone, except for a tribe that thinks women are inferior to men, treats you the same regardless of gender, and everyone hates that tribe. So this is, you know, we can talk about first-person shooters as a phenomenon, but in terms of treatment of gender, you can make choices in all your media and find stuff that actually has positive, flexible, complicated portrayals of sexuality, not just the absence of negative. You also want to look to indie media. This is a video from Immediate Justice. Anyone here know their work? I see some nodding in the back. It's a really rad organization in LA. It's a summer program that empowers young women to share their experience of reproductive justice through film. They get mentors, they write and direct films that offer a fresh take on sexual health education. Here's one of my favorites.
My body is a flower, a fragile quality of beauty and potential. It's a canvas of childhood memories, the brushes stroke and cut deep, an escape through a school of fish. I am an old jailer, restricted from everything. I am reclaiming this broken territory. My body is a site of strength and power. Set me free.
So there's a lot of power in both making our own media and also teaching the next generation to make our own media. I don't think that's the only solution. Oftentimes we talk about this as a magic solution, and obviously this video has a different level of distribution than Bridesmaids did, right? We have to do both. We have to be pushing and supporting positive images of sexuality in the mainstream media, in the corporate media, and also learning to make our own media and take over the media simultaneously. We really can't pursue only one strategy. Both of them are incomplete. There are live performers. This is Brown Girls Burlesque. They are so rad. I'm going to read you what a blogger wrote about them because I can't do better. A retro go-go girl in a bar gets watched. A real burlesque dancer watches back, winking and knowing. Now, that's one thing for white women to do with their bodies and their audiences, but quite another for women of color to negotiate. And Brown Girls Burlesque negotiates it with stunning, smart, sexy success. People are, you know, women are everywhere sort of trying to take back this space, but it's challenging work. So another thing that we can do is, of course, support organizations that are working on gender justice in media. This happens to be mine. There are a lot of other good ones. There's Spark. which is an organization working to combat the sexualization of girls and women in the media, working with girl-serving organizations. There's the Women's Media Center. There are organizations also out there trying to do this work. Chica Luna is another. I'm sure that we could share more during the Q&A. So we want to be helping to foster new ideas and new avenues of media at the same time as we're going out to support. And what I should have said about all of that, those examples of stuff that's actually breaking through in the mainstream media that has positive sexuality is, it's on us to support that stuff, right? Like, vote with our eyeballs and our clicks. And I said that the other night at my talk, but I've been talking so much about sex that everyone was like, thought that I had said vote with your clits. If my clit would vote, things would be different. But anyway, vote with what media you consume, right? And I'm not saying, I want to say just for a minute here, like, nobody has to be a purist, right? Like, you know what? I watch Gossip Girl. It's fun, okay? Sometimes it's really fucked up. But, like, it's okay to eat junk food once in a while. But if you have a diet of junk food, you're going to be really unhealthy, right? If you only eat junk food, and all of us only eat junk food, what's going to get produced? More junk food, right? So it's about finding that balance. You know, I'm not asking anybody to be perfect, because I certainly am not going to be. But we need to be thoughtful. We need to be making decisions. And when we do sit down to watch Gossip Girl or whatever your version of that is, we need to be being like, yeah, I'm going to indulge in a little junk food here. You need to be aware that you're doing that too. Because whatever you watch, whatever you give your eyeballs and your money to, more of that gets produced in the world. So even if something is maybe not your cup of tea, try and make it your cup of tea, or try and find other people to encourage. You know, try and find things that are your cup of tea that you can support, that not just don't have negative messages about sexuality, but have positive, complicated ideas. Because otherwise, the best case scenario is we have media that's devoid of images of sexuality, female sexuality at all. And that, I'm thinking of the poster that's on this wall over here. You can't be what you can't see, right? It's a lot harder to think about what your sexuality might be if it's not being modeled in the media that we're constantly consuming. Because ultimately what we want to do is take these two really limiting options at best and make them just two of many, right? If I could have made this slide 3D, I would have, because I think that there's not just one plane of the way we can think about sexuality. But also, these media changes take time, right? Learning how to produce and distribute our own media, the impact of, like, supporting media that has complex portrayals of women's sexuality. This is going to move the culture, absolutely, but it's going to move the culture at a pretty slow pace. I think that we're all aware of that, right? So in the meantime, there are things that we can be doing to educate ourselves and each other to make ourselves more resilient, more resistant to sexualization, and stronger in our own sexuality so that we're less vulnerable to all of these messages, which is maybe where my new book comes in. This is my new book. It's called What You Really, Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety. And part of the reason I wrote it is as a way to help all of us to develop a stronger relationship with our own sexualities so that we will be able to stand up to, identify these damaging ideas about sexuality that we're fed, that we're soaking in every day. It's a workbook. It does not have answers. It has questions, right? It's about a structure for you to figure out what you want to do with your own sexuality in a way that works for you. Because I've done a lot of work on my own sexuality, and I could probably tell you a lot about what I like about it and what works for me and what doesn't, but that's not necessarily going to apply to you. It's about making a you-centered sexuality instead of a sexuality that's about you being, your sexuality being put to use for other people. And that, I really do believe, is in itself an act of resistance in this culture that we've just described. I think that's an act of powerful resistance that we can all be taking, and we can all be helping each other take, and also the people that we work with take. So let's talk a little bit about what are some of those components of that healthier sexuality, and then I'm going to open it up for Q&A and comment and all of that stuff. First is practicing enthusiastic consent. Christine kind of set that up, so I'm not going to talk about it a ton. We can get into it more if you want to. Enthusiastic consent, as many of you probably know, is a very radical proposal that not only do you have to make sure that your sexual partner isn't objecting, but that they're actually pleased about whatever is happening. It's shocking, I know. I'm a radical, crazy person for proposing that, and I get told that all day long. But I stand by it, and I believe that this principle both removes social license to operate from the rapist, because it flips the question from, did you fight back hard enough, to what did you do to make sure you had consent? But it also, at the very same time, means that all of us have better sex except the rapists, right? All of us are going to increase our communication with our partners, and that's going to result, I promise you, in better sex. There's this cultural concept that we're supposed to talk about sex everywhere, right? Like we're drowning in sexual images and sexual conversations and sexual narratives in the broader culture, and the one place we're not supposed to ever talk about sex is with the person we're having sex with. Which is so messed up. First of all, the idea that talking about sex is unsexy is ridiculous. Let's think about the phone sex industry for a minute, which is like a $900 million, like it's a huge industry. People find talking about sex pretty sexy, I promise. But beyond that, you don't have to do it in a contractual way, right? You can say, I really want to do that to you. Would you like that? For example, and I think it's a lot sexier if you're not feeling unsafe, right? If you're not unsure if someone's going to pay attention to your boundaries, if you're with someone who is paying attention to your pleasure and you are doing the same for your partner, I think that's inherently sexier. So enthusiastic consent both makes sex better for most of us and also removes social license to operate from rapists if we can create it as a community accepted value, which is, you know, something that I'm working on and that I hope all of you will join me or already have joined me in that work. But in order to do that, we have to talk about consent, and Christine sort of gave a little bit of my punchline away. Consent, as we currently conceive of it in the commodity model, is a light switch, right? So it's like, do I have consent for sex? Yes, no. Now, as all of you who have had sex, some form of sex, know, sex isn't a thing, right? It's not like a checkbox, right? It's not like sex, right? Sex is sort of an evolving set of activities at any given moment, right? And so to say that you can say yes or no one time to sex is a ridiculous concept, but that's the construct that, again, like gets like you buy your ticket that you take the ride, right, on that Assange case and all the times we hear if somebody's already been sexual with someone and then either withdrew consent or didn't consent to some other sexual activity, and then, you know, same with that judge in Manitoba, like she was flirting and therefore it's consent to everything, right? It's ridiculous. It's on its face of it when you spell it out, ridiculous, and yet it's so the dominant paradigm when it comes to women's sexuality and sexual violence. Consent, not a light switch. So if consent's not a light switch, what is it? I'm going to offer you, I'm sure you all don't really need to know this, but I'm going to offer you the metaphor I use for it. What I like to say is this. Instead of being a light switch, if you were, instead of having sex, synchronized swimming with someone, consent is the water. Okay? You can't get in the water, get out of the water, and then dance around and be like, I'm having consensual sex, right? You have to stay in the water the whole time if you want to be synchronized swimming. And you have to stay in a constant, ongoing state of consent the whole time if you want to be having consensual sex, which means that you have to be paying attention to your partner. And if you can't tell if they're into it, you have to ask. I'm not going to do my whole spiel about how to do that. There's information about that in the book. So if you work with people or you yourself want information, strategies, ideas about how to make that easier, we say that, right? You have to communicate. But talking about how to do that in reality, I feel like that's awkward sometimes. I don't always do it perfectly, right? And so there are strategies in the book that get down to the nitty-gritty of that. I'm not going to do that right now. Another thing that I want to make a popular idea is that there's a huge difference between feeling safe, which sometimes means we're not safe. A lot of times the things that make us feel safe around sexuality and sexual violence actually make us unsafe. So I think, for example, about when women slut-shame other women and victim-blame them around sexual violence. When women do that to other women, I think a lot of the time they're thinking, she's making decisions I'm not going to make, and therefore the bad things that either have happened or are going to happen to her would never happen to me. So that's staying in a feeling of safety. And what we know, and everyone in this room obviously knows, is that makes you less safe. But we're attached to that feeling of safety. On the converse, the things that make us actually safe sometimes make us feel unsafe. Grappling with the idea that you can't tell from looking or interacting with someone necessarily whether or not they're sexually violent. That makes us feel terrified, especially people who are new to that concept, and therefore we don't want to look at it. And yet, knowing that and looking that in the eye can make us a lot safer. Dealing with the real risks that are out there, looking them in the eye can make us feel freaked out, but also make us safer. So a healthy sexuality acknowledges that the things that feel safe emotionally aren't necessarily making us safer, and the things that do make us safer sometimes are difficult. We want to promote healthy, complicated sexuality so that it will be harder for the rapists to get away with what they're doing and easier to deal with them, right? But also because sex is awesome. And I believe that pleasure is a universal human right, that sexual violence removes from many of us. And the threat of sexual violence removes from many of us, especially women, throughout our lives, whether or not we're ever victimized. And we create a culture that is so starved of oxygen in terms of what we can do with our sexuality. And we are living poorer lives because of it. And I believe every one of us in this room has the right to the fullness of our sexuality and the fullness of the pleasure of our lives. And also, that if we advocate for that along with an anti-rape message, it's going to be a lot easier for people to come along because it's a lot more exciting to work towards something than against it. We're just working against sexual violence. It can be difficult to hear all those hard stories and like you just feel bad and you want to look away. But it can be exciting to work toward, like, what if we had this different world that didn't have all that sexual violence? What would be the good stuff that comes from that? And I think that needs to be core, especially when we're talking about media messaging, right? What we're talking about needs to be centered. What would happen? Sexual experimentation would come back. There's this idea, especially for girls, that if you try something sexually and you don't like it, that you fucked up. That's how you learn. That's how you become resilient. That's how you learn to hone your instincts and decide what you do like. If you don't get to try stuff sexually, if you don't get to play around with it and have some stuff be awesome and some stuff be meh and some stuff be bad and learn how to deal with all those results and learn from them, like, you're also very vulnerable to manipulation because you don't have a centered sense of your sexuality, and therefore someone else can tell you what it's about and manipulate you. And also, you're just being denied the pleasure that is a liberated sexuality, that is the fullness of your sexual freedom. We need to be for that at the same time as we are so solidly, and I know everyone in this room is, against sexual violence. Those are the same thing. They come together. And the more we can emphasize that, I think the more people will be in this room. It's about the whole woman. It's about creating a world where all of us, and again, this talk focused on women, but a lot of these things pertain to men and non-gender conforming people and trans people as well, which is that we all get put in these little boxes and told what we can and can't do with our sexuality. Honestly, I think the commodity model doesn't do right by men either, right? It says men only want cheap sex with no emotional connection and will bang whoever they can, right? I think that's insulting to men, and will rape if they can get away with it. There's a lot of insult and tiny boxes for all of us here. And ultimately, doing this work of changing the conversation about sexuality in the media will not only, I believe, remove or at least dramatically reduce the social license to operate that helps rapists continue to operate, but also make our lives way better. And that is a win-win.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.